Thank you for listening to Overleveraged, where we explore the big macro themes affecting investors, economic imbalances, giant geopolitical trends, tail risks and tremors, and everywhere risks are not being fully priced into markets. Remember, trading carries risk, and all opinions are provided as general market commentary only. Please do your own research. Our risk warning will follow at the end. April 1997, just as the John Major government was in its throes, a seemingly innocuous academic paper was presented to the Institute of Actuaries. Papers like these seldom cause a ripple, but this one, called The Financial Theory of Defined Benefit Schemes, was to produce shockwaves. Controversially, this paper argued that pension liabilities were like bonds, which meant they should be hedged against market rates. This small accounting change had profound effects on the UK's financial markets and created a monster that would many years later cause turmoil in the giant government bond market and lead to profound changes in the UK equity markets. So that's all about LDI and changes to pension schemes, which we're going to discuss, and whether or not that is actually why the UK market is doing as badly as it is, certainly on some measures. So joining me today on Overleveraged is John Heumann, who is head of content at Vox Markets, former editor of Investors Chronicle, and all-round expert, really, on the UK stock market and the UK sort of equity space in general. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's
a, I hope that's not too big an intro. Yeah. So I've bigged you up. But so I guess we want to discuss why the UK market's not really punching above its weight, or indeed punching at its weight at all. And so we want to talk about this because coming up in the next week is the budget. So that's the UK's Chancellor, the Finance Minister, and his set piece event where he sets out fiscal plans, tax, spending, and so on. And there's been a lot of chatter, John, about the, you know, this British ISA. And so that's been doing a lot of the rounds, this idea that somehow you can stimulate the UK stock market by introducing better savings regimes and so on. In November, at the autumn statement, there was talk about simplifying ISAs. There was moves on doing partial transfers. But even this British ISA idea, which could increase the amount that you can save tax-free by about £5,000, does seem like it's a bit of a gimmick, given the extent of the problem that we've seen over recent years. Lately, you know, earnings multiples suffered. It's shrunk. I've got lots of stats which we can go into. But do you think that LDI stuff is a factor?
You would think it was one of many factors, for sure. It just became less attractive to invest in UK equities at that point in time. I think it's true, the ripples have been felt ever since. And you know, I know the stats that you point to in terms of you know, sort of de-equitization, the amount of companies listed on the London markets is going down, and you know, over the past few months, it's something I look at regularly, certainly in the smaller end of the market, at a rate of knots. You know, we see more companies disappear every week.
Yeah, so I've got stats from Lapthorn. Just 319 UK stocks with a 6-month average daily trading volume is $1 million or more. Over 860 in Europe, 1400 in Japan, the US is over 3000. So the UK market has shrunk a lot. It's now accounting for just 3.5% of the MSCI All Country Index. It used to be 8.5%. Charles Hall at Peel Hunt, he's head of research there, he calls it a doom loop where valuations are low, liquidity is reducing, investors are seeing withdrawals, and there's little desire to IPO. If this continues, he says, the UK could lose a crucial part of its financial ecosystem. So things are looking pretty grim.
Yeah, grim. But, you know, the question is whether it's an idea. You know, I think doom loop is fairly appropriate.
Yeah.
Because, you know, without liquidity, that there is no attraction. If you buy a share one day, and after, you know, even if the price hasn't moved, you've got to sell it for the next, because the spread will kill you. That's what happens here. And you know, so that's obviously particularly true at the smaller end of the market. But the smaller end of the market is where, you know, you would generally see the majority of flotations of IPOs. And you know, where's the attraction in coming to a market where no one's going to trade your shares? It's tough out there.
And smaller companies are shunning public markets, and that could be a chicken and egg kind of situation, but nevertheless, it's happening.
Yeah, it's happening. And you know, one of the things that you know we're seeing a lot is you know, companies. Well, I mean, arguably, is it a bad thing for the economy as a whole, or does it really matter? Is it just a market problem, and therefore we don't need to worry about it if we're thinking about the broader economy? Because a lot of companies, rather than choosing to come to market, can raise money elsewhere. They can raise it privately. No, private capital is huge now, absolutely huge, and growing, and they're sitting on dry powder, you know, like you wouldn't believe. So you know, the growth of private equity has mirrored this decline in public markets. And therefore, if you want to access the companies that you can't access on the markets, you access that through private equity, some of which is listed. So, you know, there is a certain irony to yeah. that. It's tricky to see, you know, how this can be overcome. You know, one of the, you know, obvious difficulties companies face in coming to market is that it's expensive. Yeah. It's really expensive. You know, you have to hire a lot of advisors. So you have to pay your annual listing fees to the London Stock Exchange, wherever it might be. You know, it's just simply an unjustifiable cost for many smaller companies if it doesn't deliver trading liquidity. You know, and so then you wonder about what is the purpose of a stock market. It should be to allow companies to raise the capital they need to grow. Mm-hmm. But if they can get that elsewhere, then why bother with the hassle?
Yeah, I think it's easy to put the cart before the horse and just look at the stock market as a means of speculation.
Mm. Well, I think that's what it's sort of become a little bit, to be honest.
Yeah, it's not a means to raise capital and financing for growth companies. And this is a problem because I think, you know, we do have growth companies. We do have tech stocks. We just don't have them in the stock market. So the UK is 5% tech. Germany's 11%. US about third. So maybe we do have the smaller companies, but they're not coming to the market. They're not getting on the stock market.
And when they do get onto the market, they struggle to attract, you know, investor attention. I mean, I think sort of just going back to those global figures about, you know, the proportion of UK equities in the MSCI world, you know, all of those figures have been skewed by the rise of big tech. You know,
yes.
It just accounts for such a huge proportion of the US market and therefore the global market that everything looks pale in comparison.
Yeah, I mean, you see these charts often in the newspapers and so on. There has been a shift since Brexit, but that ties in with other stuff as well. 2016, UK and global equities trading about 18.6 times earnings. Mm-hmm. Since then, UK's down to about 10, US world more like 20. So there has been a big divergence. Lots of people will say Brexit is a factor. It could well be. Certainly some of the government policy, maybe not Brexit, but the government uncertain policy making process over the last few years has certainly been a factor. But it's not like, not all stock markets have grown. So China is now trading 8 times.
Yeah, and that's a different story.
So, you know,
horror show.
And actually there has been, the US has outperformed massively. It's massive skew from the US and big tech. So it's not just a UK problem, but it's maybe just more worse in the UK than elsewhere.
It does feel that way. I mean, we're in a notoriously gloomy bunch in the UK anyway. And I think that applies to our markets as much as anything else.
I think I've got something written in here about, is it just inherent conservatism, I think is what I put down, which is maybe a more optimistic way of putting it. But yeah, gloomy bunch.
We are a gloomy bunch for some strange reason. But you know, the UK is what it's, China aside, you know, you look at it comparative to world markets, it's the cheapest of the lot. Now, you know, you could argue that actually, you know, that's not just a factor of the fact that small companies either choose not to come to market or once they get there, you know, struggle to gain traction. But that we are, you know, the FTSE 100 is still
Jurassic Park.
It's Jurassic Park. That's a very good description.
Yeah,
of it. And, you know,
it's not my description. That's somebody else's. But it's a good one.
I've not heard it before.
Yeah,
but you know, those large companies. I think sclerotic is perhaps the word you used to describe.
See, we used to use that word for France.
Yeah,
10 years ago, exactly. And not anymore.
Maybe
some people do.
But big oil banks. You know, banks are not exactly forward thinking. Really, you know, if they are forward thinking, it's because fintech has come along and sort of up the rail to give them a bit of a scare. But you know, big oil, you know, really should be. And you might disagree with this, Neil, but you know, sort of driving
change,
and, you know, driving investment in In new forms. Yeah, and they just haven't. They just don't put their capital to good use. In fact, you know, one of the arguments against the UK market is that we have this obsessive focus on dividends. And, you know, companies' dividends are what matters. They are sacrosanct. And actually, they have delivered a big chunk of total returns, certainly on the FTSE 100. But also that means that those dividends, that money that's distributed as dividends, is not being reinvested in opportunities, in things that could drive growth.
Yeah, and that's something that actually marks out the Magnificent Seven in the US. So these are the seven big stocks, your Microsoft, Amazon, Apple, Tesla, Nvidia, Microsoft, might have said that already.
And
the other one, the seven of them. Forget Chico. They invest something like 60% of their free cash, which is, I think, three times what the rest of the S&P 500 does. And it's a lot more than the tech bubble five back in 99. And it's a heck of a lot more than anyone in the UK is doing. So that reinvestment, that long-term outlook is key. And that's why I think we want to come back to this LDI story again. But
the LDI did relate to dividends. But so you know, in that sense, arguably, it should have encouraged companies to invest more in growth initiatives. Mm-hmm. It just hasn't. Like I said, I just find these, you know, these very large industries to be very, very lacking in imagination. You know, that I think is one of the reasons why attitudes to the UK are what they are. So it's from an investment perspective. You know, there are some really fantastically innovative companies on the market. RELX is one that would spring to mind. I would argue that is the UK's biggest tech company.
Not Ocado. I think I've discussed Ocado with you before many years ago.
Don't get me started on Ocado. This obsession with as I say, you know, maintaining a dividend. I mean, Shell cut their dividend a few years ago, and it's, you know,
got uproar.
The amount of headlines about that.
Yeah.
I
think that was oil had gone negative though or something.
Oil price had gone negative.
Fair days.
This is a big headwind. It's strange because in some sense it's an attraction of the UK market, but in other ways it's a reason not to invest in
it. It holds it back, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So this is I'm going to harp on about this LDI thing once more. So Sir John Kay, I think we've probably read
as a
top economist.
Yeah.
He says it's one of the great avoidable catastrophes of British public policy, because basically since then there's a IFRS 17 and IAS 19 accounting changes, which put pension deficits onto corporate balance sheets back in 2000.
Yep.
This is a long time ago, but it all comes back to this financial theory of defined benefit schemes paper. And since then, UK pension funds and the like have reduced their holdings of UK equities from about, the figures I've seen vary, but around half, say 50% to 44%, down to 4%. So they've just simply not invested. They've been a persistent seller, if you like, of UK stocks. At the same time, the holdings of gilt rose to 72% from 17%. So they've completely inverted their structures, and that has had a long-term impact.
But it's obviously matching liabilities, basically. They have to match their liabilities. And
well, it's a policy.
As a
policy, but that's the point. It's a policy change that could be changed again.
Yeah, I mean, arguably though, you know, if UK pension funds have been, you know, essentially net sellers of UK equities, that doesn't mean that other nations have to be net sellers of UK equities.
No,
because there's better opportunities elsewhere. Like we've talked about. I mean, you know, so I think you mentioned a figure at the beginning. It's, you know, 300 and odd companies that
319. With a trading volume of $1 million
with
or more.
With decent liquidity.
Yeah.
So, you know,
that's not many, is it?
It's not many at all. There are not many companies out there that, you know, if you're sitting in an office in you know, New York, you know, are you going to be fishing at the bottom end of eight? Because the liquidity is not there. The scale isn't there. You know, they're just... I mean, this is an extraordinary thing. I once, for a piece I was writing for the Investors Chronicle, looked at the British engineering and electrical engineering and defence sector and aerospace sectors all combined, and the combined market valuation of all of those sectors in aggregate in the UK is smaller than Siemens.
The Siemens?
Yeah.
So that's even more. I mean, I've got this at the top of my notes. The $2.9 trillion cap of Apple is market cap. So Apple is way more than the entire UK market.
Precisely. So the opportunities just aren't there. And so, you know, if you want to change the trajectory of the UK market, then there surely has to be greater support for the growth end of the market. You want those small companies to get bigger. Yeah. So that they attract overseas capital. So, actually what happens, you know, at the moment as well is, you know, when a company at the smaller end of the market enjoys some success and starts to grow, it doesn't stay on the market for very long at all.
No.
You know, a foreign buyer will come and snap it up. You know, we do have a habit of letting our good tech go. You know, and you know, go look at AI. You know, one of the leading companies in AI is DeepMind. It's a British company, but that fell to Google eons ago.
Yes. Arm as well.
So
there's some great companies out there, just haven't been able to access the depth of liquidity and capital markets. Yeah. So I guess that leads us neatly onto what can be done. Because there's lots of chat there. I've got, you know, Mansion House, Edinburgh, Canada model. You know, these are ideas. So Mansion House in Edinburgh sort of schemes have been talked about to reinvigorate equity markets. Do you think they can
do anything? I looked at the Edinburgh reforms and I didn't see much that really
it's tinkering,
woke
right?
me up to the, you know, this is it, this is the one that's going to change it. When, as you say, there have been various proposals on how to improve the attractiveness of the UK market before. You know, there were proposals recently to kind of make it easier for companies to float whilst, you know, retaining sort of some kind of differentiated share structure. So
you end up with Deliveroo.
And you end up with the Hut Group and Deliveroo. And arguably neither of which are really sort of tech companies.
No, well, newspaper owner.
Indeed. So, you know, I think, it is bottom-up stuff. It's really bottom-up stuff. And it is supporting growth markets. I mean, you still have to pay. Well, AIM, you don't have. There are sort of attractions to investing in AIM. Stamp.
Right.
There are benefits as a taxpayer. But we've reduced the lifetime allowance on pensions. You know, we do everything in our power to make it unattractive to invest. And at the same time, all we seem to want to do as a government, I'm getting very gloomy myself, a bit very British. And this is the other British obsession, housing.
But then there's not that much of a difference if you look at the US. I mean, we might vary from, say, Germany, where you might buy a flat with cash with your €500 notes. But that is true that we don't focus on housing and we don't have money for anything else as a result. But is that really that different from the US, though?
I don't know. I mean, in the US, people have a much more hands-on approach to their pension savings, their retirement. You know, the 401k.
401k that you always hear about,
yeah. So there are, you know, you could manage your own pension in this country. For
it's quite complicated though. I mean, I look at mine and I think, look at the platform, I look at the, I'm not going to say which one, but, you know, it's good, it's easy to transact, but it's not easy to know what the hell you're supposed to do.
Well,
should I have this amount in this and this amount in that? And you know, if I sell that, is that going to incur some stamp or some tax implications down the line? It's all... And I'm, you know, fairly well versed in this stuff, and it's complicated.
It is complicated. I find it very complicated, and I've been looking at this stuff for decades.
Yeah.
But you know, I think when I say bottom up, I actually think, you know, and this goes back to what you just said. Investment is poorly understood. Money is poorly understood.
Yeah.
Running businesses is poorly understood because everything we are taught in schools is sort of, you know, certainly from a sort of mathematical perspective, is almost entirely abstract. And actually, the tangible thing is a house. So this is what people aspire to own. I really do think there is a back to basics education thing, and it's going to take decades to work its way through the system.
I'm beyond hope.
I
agree. Yeah.
And that's what I think it takes. I think financial education, and like proper financial education from a young age, is notably absent in this country. The other thing I would say about the UK market is, you know, is this the point of maximum pessimism? Are we just writing off the UK as a screwed market because it's fallen out of favour?
So this is something that a question that I've got written down on the notes, which is it cheap for good reason or is it genuinely cheap? Is it good value, I guess?
I mean, I've spoken to a lot of UK fund managers, UK investment trust managers recently. And, you know, their view is that we are in the middle of, there's been huge overreaction to some political events like Brexit and such the like. Mm-hmm. And that there are fantastic opportunities as investors in the UK market.
Yeah.
I looked into this. There's somebody overreaction hypothesis. You know, we've overreacted negatively to dramatic events. Arguing the same way that, you know, in the US they've overreacted positively to
they're more optimistic than we are.
But you know, the underperformance we've seen could actually lead to outperformance in the years ahead. You can have mean reversion effects at work, adventurous investors, contrarians. And one guy said to me, "Go where the car crashes, because you're not going to find value where everything looks happy and glorious."
No.
And things in the UK don't look happy and glorious. Maybe that's where the opportunity lies.
Well, on that note, happy and glorious. I think that's a great way to end. A great way to end the talk about the UK equity market. So thank you, John. As ever on Overleveraged. Yeah, thank you very much for your insights. And we'll be back next time on Overleveraged to talk about the budget on Thursday. So that's the day after the budget. And John will be joining me again for that one. Whether or not there's a British ISA, what else the Chancellor has got in store for us in terms of tax and spend. And anything on specifics to do with stocks, sectors, mortgages, even the pound in your pocket. So do join us on Overleveraged next week. And do follow us, subscribe and share. Thanks very much for listening. Remember, all opinions, news, research, analysis, prices or other information is provided as general market commentary, not as investment advice, and all potential results discussed are not guaranteed to be achieved. The information may have been derived from publicly available sources, company reports, personal research or surveys. Past performance is not indicative of future performance. Trading carries risk of capital loss, and the service is available to professional clients only.